commander is by Brother Harry Tennant. Chapter 8. A man's foes shall become those of his own household. David had a large family, and this was regarded as adding to the prestige of kings and as a sign of favour from the Lord. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Psalm 127, verse 2. But clearly the rule is not an inflexible one. Within the pages of the Bible we read of the wicked with many children, and of righteous men with but few. In Israel it was easier to preserve the inheritance of land granted under Joshua when sons were born. A large family will bring both joys and problems. For David, the instruction of his children was no simple matter with such a diversity of mothers. And from later records it becomes clear that the royal upbringing in godliness and righteousness was not attended by unqualified success. An affectionate and sensitive spirit was part of David's nature, and there's little doubt that he loved his children and longed for their growth in the grace and knowledge of God. But the children of a king are surrounded by luxury and have a multitude of temptations to follow the ways of idleness or pleasure or power. And David's children were no exception, and there are signs that they were sometimes permitted to indulge themselves without restraint and reproof, even when these were necessary. One of David's sons, Amnon by name and son of Ahinoam, the Jezreelite, fell victim to a crazy passion for his half-sister Tamar. Doubtless Tamar was attractive. She was Absalom's sister and his beauty was renowned. They were the children of a royal mother from Geshur in southern Syria. In those days it was not common for young men and women to intermingle as in our 20th century Western society. Tamar would move amongst the women folk, and her meetings with Amnon would not be frequent. Amnon's desires were not the natural upsurging of love for a maid, accompanied by those delightful, pure thoughts of devotion to her person. Mere animal feelings were moving him, selfish, unrestrained desires, which burn up the man himself and leave his victim robbed, affronted and shamed. He communicated his yearnings to a friend. He was a friend of the wrong kind. And it is a monumental warning to all young men. Evil friends bring one to ruin. Let every young man take note that the best friends are those who love our highest ideals, and not those who pamper to our lower, decadent and destructive nature. Jonadab, subtle, fawning and a tool of evil things, soon arranged a meeting between Tamar and Amnon, which led to Tamar's false humiliation and Amnon's ruin. Sin never satisfies the sinner. It merely brings other sins in its train and creates a longing for further indulgence of one kind or another. Willful sin brings a man into dreadful bondage. In his exercise of liberty, he becomes a bondslave to a master whose wages are death. With her maiden's garments rent to denote the loss of her innocence, Tamar went weeping to her quarters and sat in tears with ashes in her hair. The news brought Absalom to his sister's side. Before she told him, he suspected who had done the deed. Consoling the distraught and rejected woman, for Amnon had thrust her out, he offered neither rebuke nor threat to the man who'd caused the humiliation. But deeper things were working in his mind, things concerning revenge and violence. What of David? When David heard of these things, he was wroth. The Lord's commandment had been broken, the rights of women had been crushed, and the family had been shamed. The law was clear, and Amnon should have been punished. But the king's hand was weak. Memories of Bathsheba, though the bestiality of Amnon exceeded all that David had done, rendered the king impotent to reprove or to maintain the way of righteousness. Wrath was no substitute for timely and proper action. In his heart, David knew that his own weakness had erupted in a worse form in his son. No doubt David was wroth for more reasons than one. Sin begets sin, and Amnon's folly brought unhappiness to himself, deep and searing shame to Tamar, and enmity in Absalom's heart. The cedar home in Jerusalem and the several homes of his children housed seeds of hatred and division. Sin divides man from man, but inevitably man from God. Sin is selfishness or selfness in one form or another, and brings hurt in many ways, some immediate and obvious, and some gradual and hidden. Absalom's easy and apparent normal behaviour was a mask for a scheme of revenge. 5 miles north of Bethel in Baal Hazar, 2 years after the day of Tamar's grief, a sheep-shearing feast was being held. Absalom had invited David, perhaps knowing in his heart that, as it turned out, the king would decline to come. Instead, the king's sons had arrived to share the rejoicing of the season and the hospitality of a handsome, beguiling and convivial brother. Absalom had particularly asked that Amnon should be there, and the king had consented. Whether in his heart he had suspicion of Absalom's motive, it's hard to say. But certainly David had asked, "Why should he go with thee?" Whatever misgiving there was would perhaps seem unworthy in view of the fact that the king himself had been invited. At the height of the feast, armed men, servants of Absalom, entered the room, approached the table, and slew Amnon for the sin which he had committed against his sister. He had sinned by subtlety when Tamar was invited to his room. He died by subtlety when he came for a feast and found himself in the house of death. There was pandemonium in the house, and the king's sons scattered this way and that in search of their mules to escape from a fate like Amnon's, their brother's. Rumour outstripped them on the way to Jerusalem. Rumour that all the king's sons had died at Baal Hazar at the hands of Absalom. David tore his garments and cast himself on the ground, whilst his servants stood round with their clothes rent. A family lost in a day. Such was the grief of the man chosen by God. And it looked as though his fearful sins were coming home, bringing their burden of sorrow. First, Amnon's sin with a woman, and now murder. The widening circles from the stain of his own sins cast into the pool of life, family life, were washing around the foundations of domestic happiness. It was some relief when Jonadab, the man who'd assisted Amnon to sin and who was David's nephew, came with the assurance that the sons were safe, with the exception of the marked man. This hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Jonadab knew, but he had done little to save the man to whom he was supposed to be a friend. The king lifted up his eyes and saw his sons returning, weeping and sore distressed, so much so that the whole company broke down in sorrow for the calamity which had rent the family apart and had repeated that first recorded sin between brethren, when Cain smote Abel. Sin begets sorrow for someone or other, sooner or later. And so it was that Amnon never returned to Jerusalem, the city of peace, and Absalom fled north to Galilee to Talmai, king of Geshur, his wife's father. Thus David was bereaved of one son and bereft of another. The record of David's feelings is strange and somewhat ambiguous. Absalom fled, and David mourned for his son every day. Did he mourn for Amnon or for Absalom? One would have imagined his lamentation would have been for the dead. But the account continues, "The soul of the king longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead." David longed for Absalom. His act of murder sank in the sea of David's paternal yearning, a yearning begotten of love and of strange fascination which Absalom exercised by his personal charm and beauty over a wide range of people. Amnon had reaped his own harvest. Years passed by. Joab knew David's grief and his intense longing for the return of the young man who'd fled for his life. And the captain of the army was no ordinary soldier. He was a born man of war, brave, calculating, patriotic, and strangely knit to the king. Throughout his life, Joab's courage and loyalty to David remained unwavering, until the end when he thought his own fortunes were declining, and he reckoned wrongly and joined the rebellion. And perhaps this is the key to his behaviour. His service to his superiors was directed to his own ends. It's clear that he would brook no rival, even though murder had to be committed to secure his position. But there's little evidence of any spiritual qualities in his heart. Seeing David worn out by longing, he determined to take action. A weak king might mean a weak kingdom, and that would not do Joab any good. And therefore he devised a stratagem to secure Absalom's restoration to favour. He knew David's sensitivity of conscience, and particularly his love of justice. When therefore a mourning woman came amongst those who sought judgment at the king's hand, David listened. Her sons had been fighting, and one of them was slain, and now the family was seeking to put the other to death in retribution. What was she to do? A widow without other sons. David gave judgment, and her son was to be spared. Like a boomerang, the judgment came back to the king's bosom. The king in his throne be guiltless. With a few beautifully chosen words, the wise woman from Tekoa pierced the king's heart. We must needs die, and our water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God respect any person, yet he doth devise means that his banished might not be expelled from him. The words were lightly spoken, and there was a vein of insincerity running through them, in that Joab, who thought them out, was speaking to David's heart, but not from his own. David was moved by his inner memories, his recollections of how God had restored him and brought him home, rather than banish him to death and destruction. Now he could see his own son exiled far away, and the realization of his own inaction came upon him. The woman, King Newt, continued to speak, but she had little need to do so. She had accomplished her task, and her disguise was pulled aside when the king asked, "Is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this?" The hand of Joab. This was the hand which had slain Abner, the hand which had directed Uriah to his death, and now tricked the king into restoring Absalom to Jerusalem. Ever since his great sin, David had been wide open to the intrigue and treachery of men. It was almost as though the judgment pronounced by Nathan had robbed him of the alertness to danger which had served him well in the days of Saul. In some ways, the will to resist seemed to have disappeared.